and interviews.
Welcome to the Prophecy Chronicles with your host, Paul Richard Price.
Peoria and New Orleans for allowing me and the UFO Paranormal Radio Network to do our shows live. And this is Paul Richard Price here of the Prophecy Chronicles show. First of all, before I go any further, I'd like to thank some of my friends in the good state of Louisiana around the Albany area. I want to say kudos. I did graduate from high school in that area, so I want to tell everybody hello. And tonight's guest needs really no introduction. He's a man who's been on the radio for over 50 years. He's done comedy. And he's also a paranormal investigator. I would like to introduce to my show tonight, Jerry Pippin. Hello, Jerry. How are you doing?
Oh, fine, Paul. How are you? So you got a station down in Louisiana carrying you, huh? They serve that hot Cajun food down there.
That's oh, absolutely.
Good. It's good.
Well, how
are you doing?
I'm doing great. And how are you doing, Jerry?
Okay, well, we're busy. We've got a lot of things going on, and I imagine I'll tick through them as we go through the show. So I guess the best thing is it's kind of different. You'll have to ask me questions instead of the other way around.
Okay, in tonight's show, I'd like to kind of focus on the Gary McKinnon case as well as anything new that you found out about 9/11. And first of all, let's start with Gary McKinnon. For my listeners, and I don't know who doesn't know who Gary McKinnon is, but just for a brief rundown, Jerry, for my listeners who may not know who Gary McKinnon is, who this man is, what he supposedly did, or actually he admitted that he did, and what the U.S. government is trying to do at this particular point in time to bring him over and to put him on trial. So if you would just go ahead and...
Basically, Gary McKinnon, back 7 or 8 years ago, he's a UFO... a lot of people say UFO nut, but he's interested in UFOs more than a lot of people that I know. And I know a lot of people interested in it, of course. And so he started going into the websites and seeing if he could find out some UFO information. And lo and behold, he got into one at the Pentagon, one at the Navy Department, got into a NASA computer 2 or 3 times. They caught him because he left word at each place that he'd been there. And the reason he left word was because it was not protected. In other words, these websites, highly secure websites, weren't secure at all. Basically, some of them didn't even require a password. And so he left a little word here and there that, you ought to get this fixed. And then about 2003... the UK picked him up for computer hacking. He pleaded guilty. They told him he'd have a couple of years suspended sentence. And lo and behold, the next thing you know, by 2005, the United States government is trying to bring him here to the United States, extradite him, and bring him over here and charge him as a cyber terrorist. Originally, they said that they wanted to prosecute him for 70 years. Now, first of all, we need to really explain a little bit about Gary McKinnon. He's altruistic. He's basically, got this handicap that we all know about. If you've seen a couple of the movies, especially the one with Dustin Hoffman, you understand what that means, being altruistic. And he basically, really takes to computers pretty easily. Now, he agreed later on not to use a computer, and his mother, Janice Sharp, who's been leading his defense, told me, in fact, in an email today, that he hasn't touched a computer in 2 or 3 years. Now, I asked her about Facebook, because Gary McKinnon is on Facebook, and she says it's not him, it's somebody pretending to be him. And that's one of the things you got to watch out in the world of Twitter and Facebook and all of that. Is you got all kinds of people pretending to be everybody. Now, Gary has lost his case every time. Every time it's gone someplace, he's lost. He's been fighting extradition. He's now in the Human Rights Court. The last hope he had was in July. And they said that the United States could go ahead and extradite him. But the interesting thing is, all these years, the United States has not made an effort to extradite him at all. I personally don't think they're going to. And neither does Janice either. She sent me an email today talking about the fact that the political climate at the UK at this time is such that she doubts that any of these politicians would agree to turn Gary McKinnon over to the United States. However, they do have a treaty for extradition, and it's basically based upon whatever the United States says. You don't have to prove much. It's one of those Patriot Act things with the terrorism. And basically, they could pick him up at any time. But she doesn't think that's going to happen. Now, a lot of people say, well, he got into those computers, and he shouldn't have done that, and that's true. But I think he needs an award for finding the holes in it. And we need to put this in perspective. Robert Gates, our Secretary of Defense, said the other day, and this is pretty much a quote, tens of thousands of intrusions into U.S. military computers happen every month. So now they're going to single out Gary McKinnon. It's basically a deal where Gary McKinnon, alerted them how their security was. It was very poor. I mean, obviously, he's not a real terrorist. He left these notes on the computers telling them their security was just the kind of thing that a terrorist could get into. So instead of rewarding him, they decided to try to prosecute him. And he was arrested in March of 2002. But interestingly enough, the UK allowed him to stay online from the date of his arrest, which is March 2002, to June 2005. And he obviously didn't abuse that privilege whatsoever. He didn't get in any other trouble. A lot of people are wondering why Gary McKinnon is being singled out. Well, Gary McKinnon told several people, including us in an interview several years ago, that he thought 9/11 was an inside job, but he's not the only one that thinks that in the world. And he basically, went into the computers to try to find out something there, too. Maybe he did find something and he didn't recognize what he found. You know, that happens quite a lot. We don't really know what the deal is, other than I can tell you this much, the United States doesn't want him too badly, or they would have picked him up by now. And Janice, his mother, a lovely lady, by the way, I've been married to the same man for, I think, 30, 35 years, even though Gary was a child of a previous marriage. Janice is quite an entertainer. All the entertainers, including Sting and quite a few others in the UK, have really picked up on Gary McKinnon's case. And his mother basically says what Gary McKinnon did was a mistake because he didn't have a lawyer. He took the people at their word. He signed a confession. And we all know that there are other cases where, you know, other hackers are walking around free. So it's just kind of a strange case all the way around.
Okay, and what did Gary find out when he actually infiltrated these systems? I mean,
well, he found out all kinds of things. Some of it is pretty hard to believe. Some of it, he might have gotten into some disinformation. It's hard to tell exactly what he did find. I mean, he has talked about it quite a lot. And one of the things that he's talked about more than once is the fact that, you know, he found evidence of a space force. In other words, supposedly we have a secret space force out there with people traveling between Mars and Jupiter and wherever. And yet we still have this NASA space program. Now, that's pretty hard to believe, but there are a lot of people out there that are beginning to suspect that there might be something like that going on. I'm not really convinced that is the case, but it could be. You know, nothing surprises me these days. Gary actually just kind of wandered around and left notes. An interesting thing about it, the judge at the last hearing said that the passwords aren't propriety, and they aren't property, and they can't be stolen. So I don't know what they're saying that he did that was wrong. I guess if you were, you know, you had a truck full of gold, and you had it insured, and you left the truck door open, and somebody came in and got the gold, I doubt that the insurance company would pay you for the loss. But here they're trying to prosecute McKinnon, or at least they're telling him. And I must tell you, it's taken a real toll on him and his family. Probably this 7 years of punishment has been worse than if they'd, you know, brought him over here right away.
So
and we get a lot of people, you know, that write me all the time about Gary McKinnon. I get lots of emails and lots of calls, and about a third of them seem to think that Gary should have the book thrown at him. But I don't quite understand their reasoning, but that's kind of the climate we have these days. But it looks like, and Janice thinks, that's his mother, thinks that probably nothing will happen, that they'll never extradite him. He's in the Human Rights Court again. They did win a level 3 victory, whatever that means. I'm not a human rights lawyer. And there's an Article 8 that they're going to have another hearing on. So, I mean, I think it's incredible that he's been able to, you know, stay in court all of these years and stop extradition, even though the UK has ruled every time that the United States has a right to extradite him because of an extradition treaty they signed right after 9/11, and the war on terrorism really got started big time. So that's kind of it in a nutshell, Paul.
Well, one thing I wanted to bring up, too, is the mere fact that in certain email rings that you and I are a part of, you have individuals who, some are known in the UFO community, have stated that he needs to be brought over and he needs to be tried. But in my opinion, you know, and I do believe in the order of law, no matter whom it might be, whether or not it's the everyday man or woman, walking down the street, if I did something wrong, I would want somebody to, you know, to have the courage to convict me for what I did. It should go as high as the president, vice president, members of Congress. You know, if people do things that go against the letter of the law, then they should be prosecuted. However, in this case, how many other people have done more damage, in effect, with national security issues than Gary McKinnon has ever done, but they were never tried, never arrested, never prosecuted for it? And there are millions of people out there, or at least thousands of hackers, who break into computer systems every day. They know about. But are they throwing the book at them? More than likely.
Yeah, basically, as I quoted Robert Gates, it happens quite a lot. And so, as a result of that, I don't know. I don't think it's all that serious of an offense to begin with. If the thing was open, you get in there. Then we get into a philosophical thing. I mean, why do we have so many secrets? The last time I checked, the war against terrorism, the terrorists, they don't have a Navy, Army, Air Force. Yet we spend as much money as we did in World War II. It seems to there's something out of kilter here. And basically, the people that want to, you know, throw the book at Gary McKinnon and other people, some of them are outraged, I guess, but most of them, I think, they're motivated by fear. Kind of the way I look at it.
And if we look at it from a fear aspect, we can actually go back to even over 40-plus years ago after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and how many witnesses would not buck the government due to the fact that they were afraid of any repercussions. Now, we can even stray from that particular point of view. We can go back even further to July 4th, 1947, and the Roswell incident to show one of the precursors as to where they use threats and intimidation. The United States government has been doing that.
And well, you know, we've been covering Roswell really like a blanket for a long time. And by the way, we're making a TV special, a documentary, with Robert and Anthony Miles. They produced Fast Walkers.
Yes.
I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, documentary.
Oh, yeah.
It's a high-definition theatrical release. We expect to get it on a major network, and we can't make the announcement yet, but, you know, we don't want to screw anything up. It looks very good. We spent a lot of time on it already. It's called Roswell Revelations and Beyond. And not only with our radio shows, which we've been broadcasting, you know, at jerrypippin.com now for 6 years from Roswell every year. And before that, of course, we covered Roswell as well, but not as strongly as we have the last 6 years. And so we have gotten to know all the players, all the investigators, most of the witnesses that are still around. And I do think that I could go into court tomorrow if I were a lawyer and present a case, convince a jury of 12 people, circumstantially, that Roswell did have a UFO crash. I mean, just this year, there's so many things happening. For instance, Anthony Begalia has come up with a lot of research on the memory metal, supposedly the metal that moves in shape and very lightweight, that they retrieved from the UFO crash. He's done a lot of work on that and shown that actually by 1949 there was at least one company that was doing a lot of work on this and back engineering it. And as a result of that, you know, there have been several people come forward over the years talking about that they knew first and second hand that back engineering was happening. A fellow by the name of Price, I don't think he's related to you, but he worked with Lockheed at the Skunk Works as a design engineer. He recently told George Filer that he knew people in his organization that had seen the crash material and also had seen the ET bodies. We could go on and on and on. There's just so much evidence, and I would urge people to go over to our website and check it out. We have a complete Roswell section and all of the late-breaking news on this, and there's quite a few things happening. All kinds of stories have been circulating, and, you know, where there's smoke, there's usually fire. And I'm just convinced that the UFO crash did happen, and it did happen in 1947. It happened, the only thing that we don't have really verification for was whether it was July 2nd at 11:30 at night, or July 3rd or July 4th. According to which researcher you talk to, we have a Freedom of Information request in about that right now to get the bait pinned down. There's quite a few people that have said that, you know, there was a truckload of debris that came through town at 3 o'clock in the morning in Roswell. And, Paul, you lived there, so you know you can't, especially back then, you couldn't go back to the Army base without passing that the main intersection downtown. And so, it just appeared, you know, there's a fellow still alive that was, he was a sergeant, and he saw in the bomb bay of the B-29 part of the wreckage. And his story is that he saw it in October. Now, if you stop and think about it, that may not mean that anything is any, you know, that there's something screwy here as far as the dates. If I was in the Army, I know how they work. I don't think they'd ship it all in one plane load, because what happens if that plane crashed? So, you know, they'd ship it in piecemeal basis to wherever they were shipping it to. And it appears Bob was right, Patterson Air Force Base, simply because, if nothing else, Barry Goldwater on Larry King in 1994 basically talked about the fact that Curtis LeMay, the general, famous general in the Air Force, had chewed him out because he had called him up. And, you know, Goldwater was not only a senator and a presidential candidate, but he was also a general in the United States Air Force Reserve, a pilot. And he asked if he could go to the Blue Room at Wright-Patterson and see this stuff. And LeMay used every word in the book on him, told him never to ask, and Goldwater on that television show said, "I never ask again." But it does appear that they did turn this stuff over to several contractors, defense think tanks, and they've been investigating at least this one crash, if not more. You know, there's a crash retrieval conference held every year by Ryan Wood out in Las Vegas, and he has lots of evidence about lots of crashes, and a lot of it's pretty believable.
Well, here's another thing I want to bring up to you. As my listeners know, my father was a witness to the event, and even from what he told me, he and his brother, Uncle Elwood, when my dad was 8 years old back in 1947, went up there and picked up debris from the impact site, which was 45 miles north-northwest of Roswell, New Mexico. Now, this was around July 2nd, from what he recalled, and that it was a radar operator who knew my uncle, who was a World War II war hero and veteran of Normandy, D-Day, in World War II, had informed him that the Army radar at the Roswell Army Airfield had tracked a unknown object entering their airspace and they knew exactly where it impacted during a thunderstorm. Well, my dad and my uncle went out to the debris site either on the second or the third, and went out there before the area had been cordoned off by military police. And my father picked up debris and stuffed it in his coat pockets, as well as my uncle at the time. And this would kind of confirm the stories that came out, like from the day after Roswell, Philip Corso, as well as others stating that the Army did track that unknown objects on radar before the impact occurred.
And that whatever happened to the debris they picked up?
That's a good question. My father told me they had had it for 2.5 years after the after the story had all but gone and died.
Yeah, I've talked in detail with your father.
Okay, so you know about that. And he doesn't remember what happened to it after that. They had moved and all. They had built a carport to do car repairs using military-grade aircraft cement. And what I believe that they did, they hid it there in that carport at the old farm that they used to live at. Well, here's an update on that story. That area had not changed in over 60 years. The carport was still there. You know, you could tell it, you know, over the years it had aged and weathered. But recently my aunt Connie, who lives in Roswell, went by the old site and said that she had found that area where the carport was had been cemented over. Now, I did tell people that I suspected that they may have hidden the debris in that carport, you know, cemented it and put it inside the cement. And what I think happened is that somebody went in there, dug it up, and then covered the whole area after they dug up the whatever may have been left. Dug it up.
Who do you think would do that?
Some people in the Defense Intelligence Agency, and one person in particular. I'm not going to mention his name, but I'm on the air tonight. But I believe that it was a group of current and former intelligence officials who knew about this and wanted to get that debris. And now they're claiming, and I'm going to let people on my show know tonight, that particular group now claims that they have in their possession pieces of the memory metal that came from the Roswell crash. And that's been confirmed in emails. And I think I know where they got the memory metal from. From my dad's shoebox that they had cemented up in the old...
Well, there's 2 or 3 pieces of that floating around, probably. Magala really has the evidence that they turned it over to a company there in Columbus. And Barry Goldwater called Curtis LeMay the keeper of the key of all the crash retrieval stuff at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And that's probably true. That seems to be, most people seem, even Corso talks about that, you know, even though he was at Fort Riley when he opened up that crate and saw the ETs. And here again, a lot of people question that, but as I mentioned earlier, the Army probably wouldn't fly it all together. They would ship some of it. There's even a good theory in 2 or 3 witnesses that talk about maybe some of the stuff was moved down to Carlsbad Cavern. You know, basically that's because it's not very far from Roswell and it has temperature control. It's always underground. It's pretty good temperature, I think 60 or 70 degrees. So, you know, the problem with all of this is now we're 62 years away and the Undertaker has been here and taken most of the witnesses. But we have found while we're doing this documentary, Roswell Revelations and Beyond, we've had found some new witnesses, new people who, you know, they're 82, 83, 84, still around. And the interesting thing now, the bad part is, of course, that the memory and the years have taken their toll on their recollections. But the good part is they no longer fear retribution from the government. They figure they're 84. What the hell can the government do to me? One guy said that. What can Uncle Sam do to me now? So I think we're probably not going to have this TV documentary done or released until February, for the February sweeps month we're planning on. I have two or three. I have a hunch we're going to break some news on that. Let me just say it that way. I think we've got a couple of people that are going to be pretty ironclad witnesses that the testimony can't stop.
Well, here's another thing I want to bring up, and it goes back to what you and I were talking about originally, and it's to show just how the government has used coercion and intimidation over the years to scare people into shutting their traps and not talking. And we're talking about not only Roswell, we're talking about later on the Kennedy assassination, the probable October surprise event in 1979-1980 time frame, as well as 9/11. There's a pattern here. And people who were witnesses to these events were either intimidated into shutting up and or murdered. Or, let me put it this way, the unfortunate experiencers of unfortunate accidents. I mean, how many times, Jerry, can a person trip and fall inside a bathroom, inside a bathtub, and break their neck, or trip down a flight of stairs, or cross...
Now, who are you talking about that?
Well, we're talking about also, individuals who were witnesses to the Roswell event, who, even my father stated, died under mysterious circumstances. We're looking at further on the Kennedy assassination, and even 9/11, some 9/11 witnesses died under mysterious circumstances. Now, being that these are the case, and this is... To use a coin phrase that came from Lyndon Baines Johnson, that the government's become murder incorporated. What are we seeing now? Is this just a cult-type scenario where people are, even though they may not need to fear anything, are under fear because of what may happen to them if they talk about this particular data and information? Whether it be like a Gary McKinnon, who's now getting threatened under the Patriot Act to being deported and brought over here for trial for something that even a college student here would do, you know.
Well, they haven't done it yet, and they use this fear. I had never really thought of fear as being the motivator, evidently, that it is. So the government doesn't have to knock off a lot of people. And I don't think for a moment, even though I'm the Mr. Conspiracy guy, I don't think for a moment that there's, a murder incorporated running amok in the government. I do think, like you take 9/11, it wouldn't take very many people to pull that off. You know, what happens with the government, the good news is that this need to know really works. In other words, no one talks to anybody else about anything because what they're doing is top secret. Well, that's the good news. The bad news is that it slows everything down. Nobody is talking to anybody. They can be in the same room working on the same project, and it may take them a year to figure out the other person's doing something similar that they could have, had some communication. and immediately things would have been solved. So if 9/11 were a conspiracy, and I do think it was, I don't think it was even close to the official story, and we can talk about that if you want to, but it wouldn't take many people pulling off their part of the operation and not realizing that they were helping someone else do something. It's kind of like one of those old TV shows years ago when the guy said, "Oh, I love it when the plan comes together." And basically, that's how this works. And so you get people. Now, what did President Bush know about it? I don't know. He wouldn't necessarily have to know about it. What he would be doing was be reacting to the events as they happened. Now we could I don't know. I don't have any evidence, so it's all supposition. And I'm not in the fairy tale business, Paul. I'm in reporting facts, or at least things that could lead to a conclusion of facts. And so I try to be pretty careful on who I point the finger at. But there's quite a few people, and we're doing a 9/11 series. We've taken our good time with it. And the reason is we want to watch this stuff fall out. You know, things kind of shake loose. People kind of screw up as they go along in life, and they begin to tell things that they shouldn't be telling about. And we're right on now on our next show that we're doing on 9/11. I got a very interesting story with a police officer who was I think on the 17th floor of Tower 2, and she and a couple other officers that were with her found a guy in a business suit with a backpack and a teddy bear. And he was, they thought he was acting suspicious, and he didn't want to leave, and he was just delighted that things were falling apart there. And they arrested him, and they can hear the show when it comes up in early September at jerrypippin.com. But they arrested him and took him down and turned him over to the FBI. And the initial check showed that he was a member of an armed forces unit in Eastern Europe, but he was in civilian clothes, and in fact in a suit, and he just was out of place completely. Well, after she finished all of her duty, off-duty stuff, it was 10, 11 o'clock that night, she went down to the station to see what happened to her prisoner, and guess what? They had released him. And they said, "Well, we got orders from the FBI said to let him go. That he had nothing to do with it. He was probably just insane." So they didn't even keep him for a mental charge. And there's stories like that after story after story. And so our job is to try to get those stories back into place. It's like a jigsaw puzzle, and let them tell the whole truth. The truth is out there. We say that about UFOs, but it's out there on all of these things. You keep bringing up JFK. Well, I'm with Jim Mars on that. It's all of the above when we talk about the suspects. And probably this is what happened with 9/11. It was a perfect storm. You had the NORAD exercise going on that day. And, it's pretty legendary that there were false blips on radar screens. And when the hijacked plane from Boston suddenly disappeared off the radar, and obviously it was being hijacked, the FAA said, "Is this a part of the exercise?" Now, we know that the Air Force can scramble jets. In fact, they did more than once with airplanes that are running loose. Remember the golfer Payne Stewart? They scrambled the jet, and it was up there by that private plane within 15 minutes when the pilot had passed out because of lack of oxygen. And you're telling me that 45 minutes later, from one plane to the other, they couldn't get a jet out there? The reason they couldn't is they were getting, there was this exercise going on. And it involved exactly what actually happened. Now, we can go into all kinds of details about 9/11, and all these theories are interesting. And the problem I see that most people are trying to do is saying it's that theory or this theory, and it's not it. It's all of the above. They were all doing something. We talk about high radiation and a high incidence of cancer later with the rescuers. And then we talk about perhaps there were many nukes put there. And then we talk about maybe there's a particle beam. Dr. Judy Wood, she talks about that. You know, Brookhaven, New York's not very far from there where they do that kind of experiments. Then we talk. We go on to two or three other scenarios. It can be all of them. A little bit of all of them.
Well, let me bring this up here. What about the fact that even in the audio and video, videos that were taking homemade as well as news broadcasts, where you could hear pop, 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 pop.
Well, we have recordings. One from WINS in New York, a local news station, in which you can clearly hear the pop, pop, pops in the background in Building 7 as it's coming down. All of this is pretty apparent if anybody's paying attention. But you're talking about an event. So many things happened in so short of a time. And then people reported certain news stories which may or may not have been true. Now, I can tell you this much. I've been in broadcasting all my life, as you mentioned, and I've covered many breaking news events. And when somebody hands me a bulletin off the wire or one of our reporters says to you, we've got this story and it appears so, you don't question them. You just turn it over to them. In other words, you read whatever's breaking. And so did the media, jump in there and help with this surprise party? They did, but not willingly. It wouldn't take very many. Just, for instance, the Fox News helicopter that was showing the impact of Plane 2 going into the second Twin Tower. Nobody else has a picture of that. Everybody get that feed from Fox. Now, is everybody going to question Fox? We don't know who the helicopter pilot was. Fox won't talk about it. Says it's none of our business. It wouldn't take but somebody shooting a shot of the building and another and he knows something pre-recorded there is insanely fantastic as that sounds. It's done on television every day, and I'm sitting in the control room, and I got the feed from two places down the hall or across town. To me, I'm not going to be looking at it to see if it's real or not. I'm taking it for real. It's from a news organization, and the news organization themselves may think it's real. But don't take two or three people in that one control room wherever it is.
Well, here's another thing, and we have about four and a half minutes left of the show right now. But one point I want to bring up about 9/11 that people forget is that even after the impacts happened in the World Trade Centers, there was photography from helicopters that were crossing the flight path of the World Trade Center showing women and men waving white flags trying to get help. And this was supposedly after those planes impacted and after the fuel had ignited and supposedly burnt so hot that the columns lost their structural integrity. Now, if they were burning that hot, why is it that you see a woman in a purple dress, blonde hair, waving a flag, trying to get help, begging for help, if she shouldn't be there, bottom line?
Well, there's been never in the history of mankind buildings falling in their own footprints like that from air collisions. It's never happened since. And there have been hotel fires. There have been collisions with planes crashing into things. It's never happened before. And then you know, you start following the money, what happened with the money later. And that's a pretty incredible story, too. They switched insurance companies just a few months before this happened. Able to get double indemnity. They were going to have to, do a lot of work there because of asbestos. And it was a turkey. This whole thing was, as far as anybody buying it. And so you follow the money. Even the guy who wrote the insurance there on the 17th floor ended up being the viceroy of Iraq later, appointed by Bush, and they gave him, according to the GAO, sacks full of money. The money was not United States currency. It was dollar bills, but it was from Saddam Hussein's accounts in New York that we had seized. And they gave it to him to take it back over to Iraq to pass out, which he did. According to the GAO, it passed out about half of it, about $4 billion. And so somebody made a little money there. And there's money being made all along if you follow the money, and that's the way to get to the conspiracies. Follow the money. It's pretty simple. Happened in Watergate. Happens in all of them. Follow the money, and nobody's been following that.
Well, one more thing I want you to do before we have to sign off tonight. Will you tell my listeners how they can get a hold of you?
How did I what?
How do they can get a hold of you, your website?
Oh, how do they get a hold of me?
Yes.
Just simply, I have my phone number on my website. You can call me or you can email me at jerry@jerrypippin.com. Anybody's got any information about any of these things we've talked about, we'd love to talk to you about it. We'll do everything we can to protect you. Which is, I think basically the problem with trying to get people to come clean 9/11 or some of these other things is we're talking about murder, and there's no statute of limitations, and many people have gotten the death penalty for being associated with murder plots. So it's a pretty serious situation. And we definitely are looking for film, and there's some around, someplace, on Roswell, the old 16-millimeter grainy military films. If you've got any access to any of that, get a hold of us, jerry@jerrypippin.com.
Okay, well, we have less than 1 minute left in the show, and I would like to thank Jerry for being on my show today. And, Jerry, I'd like to get you on later on whenever you get some new updates, and by the way, if you would, please. And, by the way, my show next week will have another special guest, but I'll keep that secret. For right now, this is Paul Price with the Prophecy Chronicles. You will find the truth here. What you do with it is up to you. Paul Price signing off for this week. Thank you, and God bless. You have a good day. Yeah.